Hello, friends, and welcome to the Gospel Beautiful podcast. I'm your host, Michael Chan. Today's conversation is with Pastor Carl Johnson. It's pretty difficult to know where to begin with Pastor Johnson, in part because he has a breadth of vision that is really matched only by his depth of passion and love for the gospel and especially for hurting people. Carl has an incredible story of coming to faith. He has an incredible story around the ministry that he's doing in St. Paul. And so in many ways, I just want to let Carl speak for himself, especially when we start digging into his vision for the gospel. But just by way of introduction, I want to say that he is the pastor of Faith City Church in St. Paul, which services in particular the Dayton's Bluff neighborhood. He's also deeply involved in the G.W. Carver Cultural Center, which is slated to launch later this year. That's also in St. Paul. The G.W. Carver Cultural Center is a cultural space that seeks to create a safe place for Black and Brown communities where they are both affirmed and able to cultivate innovation and creativity. So in that brief description of the G.W. Carver Cultural Center, you get a sense of Carl's kind of innovative and creative spirit, but also his desire to serve the communities around him. You'll hear this later in the conversation, but I think in so many ways, Carl represents a kind of modern apostolic ministry that I think is really powerful and most especially grounded in the power of the gospel for all. So I think you all are going to appreciate it. It's going to be a great conversation. If you have recommendations for future guests, you can reach out to me at mchan002@luthersem.edu. And otherwise, we're now going to hear just a few words from our sponsors, and then we will turn straight to my conversation with Carl. Thanks. Baker Academics serves the academy and the church by publishing works that further the pursuit of knowledge and understanding within the context of Christian faith. They connect authors and readers across the broader academic community by publishing books that reflect historic Christianity and its contemporary expressions. Baker Academic authors are scholars who are leaders in their fields, write ironically, and display a healthy respect for other perspectives and traditions. Baker Academic is a proud sponsor of the Gospel Beautiful podcast. Thank you for listening.
Hey there, Gospel Beautiful podcast listeners. This is Brian Schrader, creator of Worship Forward, a resource for progressive, innovative worship leaders. Here you'll find conversations about arranging hymns for your worship band, using song lyrics that promote justice, and how to choose great worship songs to use at your church. Check it out at worshipforward.blog.
Reverend Carl Johnson, thanks for joining me, man.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Well, I've been looking forward to this one for, I don't know, like 6 months we've been talking about.
Yeah.
We were in the Seeds Fellowship together here at Luther Seminary, and you and I ended up by the good work of the Spirit together in a group. And I just, from the very beginning, reading kind of your profile and learning about the incredible work that you're doing here, that you've done here in the Twin Cities and beyond, I was just really excited to have you. So thanks for saying yes.
No, thank you for the opportunity. This is a blessing. Your bio as well is amazing, and it's also like such a great opportunity to be able to sit down and talk with you in person.
Thanks. I appreciate it. You know, as I was prepping for this and just kind of praying through, Carl, sometimes in the Old Testament we talk about signs and wonders,
yeah,
right? Which is, I love that language of signs and wonders. And your life story is a sign and wonder. And so I wondered if, even before we jump into like the ministry stuff, can you just tell a little bit about, like, give your testimony, say a little bit about your story?
Yeah. So at age 6, my parents were divorced. By age 12, I started drinking. By age 17, I was on the streets selling drugs, and I was part of an offshoot of the Nation of Islam called Five Percenters. And then by age 22, I was in jail 6 times. And when I was 29, I was close to making the greatest decision of my life. And then here we are.
Well, fill out what's that. Talk about that great decision and like what brought you to
that. I know some people may not believe in like decisions, but there was a decision I had to make of was I going to be obedient and follow Jesus? And when I made that decision, my whole life changed and transformed into something that we're here now.
Seeing. Yeah. I mean, who was involved in that decision? Like, what brought you to that place where you had to make this big decision and become a man of faith?
Yeah. So there's a lot of conversation around like recovery and redemption and addiction and especially now. But the people that came around were people who have already been redeemed in my family from alcohol and drug abuse. I had an uncle who was in Teen Challenge, like old school Teen Challenge. Yeah. Like, and he was in Rearsburg, Pennsylvania, and they call it the Mountain. That's what they call it. And he was there, and he was delivered from heroin. And he has like 8 kids now, and has been not on heroin, drinking, smoking, nothing, for the past 22 years. And he gave me a call out of the blue when I was in my lowest moment, and actually asking God how this is going to change.
Wow.
And he gave me a call and told me I could go to the same program he went to, the Teen Challenge, yeah, and said, call them on Monday and they'll pick you up on Wednesday. And that was it. And from there, that was how it got involved. And that's how I went into the program. But God had already moved upon my heart to change something. Hmm.
But this was pretty decisive for you.
Yeah.
Like I think this is what kind of sets you apart, where you've sort of found your voice around these issues of kind of recovery and addiction. Like, for you, deliverance, it's like the Exodus. Like, it happened.
Right.
Right? Like, this is something that happened historically in the past. And for you, that's an important theological claim. What's going on there?
Yeah. So, for me, I think there's a difference when we talk about the redemptive plan of Jesus and we talk about recovery and we talk about people who are addicted. I actually believe, like, recovery, what are you recovering from? Like, when we have this kind of conversation, are you recovering from the injury of the addiction? Are you recovering from the downfall? Are you recovering from the situation and circumstance that you messed up? And then redemption is so much greater because it says you are going back to the original design in which you were created. And to me, that's such a much more powerful thing to be delivered to and from.
From and to.
Yeah, that makes it such a difference. And when I realize that, oh, I'm being redeemed. Like, time is being redeemed. Relationships are being redeemed. Family's being redeemed. I'm just not in this recovery process. I'm in a redemption. And I'm part of the redemptive plan. Like Paul says, like, he says, I get on my knees and I recognize that I am part of the story of God. Hmm. And when I pray that I start to obey God as a part of his grand redemptive plan. And I just believe that, yeah, without a shadow of doubt that I'm part.
Yeah, and part of what the Lord has redeemed you to,
yeah,
is not only family,
yeah,
right? You have a beautiful family,
yeah,
kids, a growing dog.
Yes, very much so.
Giant, we both have giant dogs, or you'll have. You will soon have a giant dog. Yeah. I've got one. But also ministry, and I think you know, sometimes in certain segments of Christianity, like the kind of the more charismatic Pentecostal ones, sometimes like the word apostolic gets thrown around,
yeah,
a lot. Or sometimes people, you know, have that as part of their title, and all that's fine. Don't need to throw shade on that. But when I look at your ministry, I think it is deeply apostolic,
yeah,
in a couple different ways. Like, one is it's pressing into new territories. And I don't mean that just in terms of, like, I don't mean that mainly in terms of the physical spaces. I mean the way that you're thinking about ministry, yeah, and engaging. So there's this kind of apostolic edge. Like, does that resonate with you?
And oh yeah,
he has to talk a little bit about that.
It's kind of your Old Testament so we kind of call it the Abrahamic like mindset more than the apostolic, because Abraham was somebody that went into new territories,
right,
and had new things at an older age. And yeah, and I think when I think about like the apostolic, and to me it was described to me very early on that it is forward thinking. It's not just saying I'll go into new territories. It means that I am a forward thinker. that I think for the future, I see the big plan. I'm a macro, I'm a global vision type of person. And so that means that I don't think about the details all the time.
but you gather, you surround yourself with right, people who are good at that stuff.
Yeah, so I think that's when it comes to that apostolic leadership, that I am able to see the big picture of the things that are happening around us and with us and in us, that makes the apostolic to me alive in people. Like in the organizations and the networks I'm in, I'm able to see that in folks, like where their forward thinking is happening and how we all play a part in that.
Yeah, no, that's helpful. And as you kind of survey the peers around you, the people kind of in, within our age group, you know, and people doing similar kinds of ministry, who do you look at and say that person also kind of has an apostolic mantle, or that person operates in that kind of way? People that might inspire you is kind of what I'm getting at.
There's a couple people. If I want to say the person that's localized to me is the director of our church plant network called Ethnos Global Network. His name is Yukon Chu. Yukon is one of the major apostolic leaders. We have a global network on three continents. He's able to manage relationships and connections and build new territory within that. And also, at the same time, remain humble and listen and guide and even correct his own mistakes in the midst of the problem. And it's just like, man. He is like a leader, like an Antioch leader. Like, to me, that's how I feel. Like, he's an Antioch apostolic. Like, he is building the base of the church that will be decentralized and that will help spread it. And so that's the first person that I look at that's like, oh, man, he's apostolic.
Yeah.
And then the second person is Jesus. When we look at Jesus and we just think he was just starting a movement, he started something that he didn't even get to taste. I mean, to me, that is something that is really, that's really crazy. We live in a world where we think we're supposed to see the fruit of everything. I think the parable of the fig tree has been like going on in me. So when I think about Jesus, he is saying that fig tree was fakely producing fruit. It wasn't producing real fruit. And he got upset that this thing that was part of creation, that its original design was to produce fruit, but it had stopped. And I thought about that, and it brought up something like Jesus called us to be faithful, and God was supposed to bring the fruit. So this tree was actually not like in tune with nature and what was going on. It was actually like an abnormality for Jesus. And he was like, you no longer can't even exist. He curses the tree and it withers up and dies because it no longer is moving in the direction that is designed. And when you think about how Jesus can speak such powerful words to creation and say, this is the direction I want creation to go into. If you don't produce fruit in the original design, and you can actually no longer be relevant.
Yeah. I don't want to like read too much into your words, Carl. But is there a critique in that you think might, you know, that the contemporary churches might benefit from hearing?
Yeah, we can't be fruitful without being faithful. And I believe that Jesus is saying we were making idols of the fruit in the tree. Like when we look at the tree, it looks pretty, the leaves look healthy, everything is amazing, but actually in the midst of it, it is not fruitful at all. And Jesus is like showing this like parable, like things that are not fruitful are not going to last. And God's the one who's going to bring the fruit. And even in myself, I look at that parable and I say, what idol have I made of the fruitfulness and not the faithfulness?
That's interesting.
Yeah.
And I know, Carl, you've spent time, your own ministry is very much on the edge of things.
Yeah.
But you've also spent a lot of time in, I guess, what you could call kind of traditional mainline settings.
Yeah.
And you're familiar sort of with that world. What kind of reflections would you have for a lot of the pastors and leaders who listen to this podcast are pretty well within the, you know, I think traditional mainline churches. What do you see in, you know, in those denominations that you wish were different, or what might be a word of wisdom you might share. Just about where we're at in this moment right now.
I think it's something that even my own church, where we're facing that, and where I would say, pastors, your liturgy is not bad. You don't have to change your groups or any of those kind of, or the way that you move. But what you have to do is recalibrate and reexamine your purposes. You have to reexamine your values. You have to reexamine your convictions.
The why questions.
Yeah. God is asking us in this moment not to just say, hey, I'm a just God, but ask why we haven't been just with people around us. There's a lot of church hurt. There's a lot of deconstruction. There's a lot of atheists and apologetics and how God is imaginary. And I think one of the things that I heard somebody tell me about millennials is not millennials don't like church, because the Anglican denomination is growing in millennial congregants. That's not the problem. It is that we told them about a Jesus, and then we made it seem like, oh, we'll never see him. You just have to believe it. And so the millennials are like, I want to feed the poor. And as soon as you feed the poor, like somebody was saying, you say you're going to feed the poor and you want to change the system of poverty, you're a communist now or a socialist. And so, like, when you start to lean into the real things of, like, what Jesus said, and you're not any of those political parties, you're actually doing exactly what the scripture commands us to do when feeding the poor and taking care of widows. Like, the last time we've taken care of widows in the U.S., I would doubt that the church has picked that mantle up in a long time. And that would mean that we would be taking care of single mothers and mothers who are widows from police violence. And we separate ourselves from those situations. And yeah.
Yeah, no, a part of the reason I wanted to ask that question about just what I appreciate about what you said about sort of what matters and the why and all of that is, like, just before this conversation, you handed me this book. You gifted me this little book.
Yeah.
Praying the Psalms with Augustine and Friends.
Yeah.
And what that tells me, and from what I know about you, is that for you, it's not about abandoning the tradition. The tradition is not the problem.
Right.
Right. For you, you're leaning heavy, right, into, of course, the Bible, right? You're a Bible loving guy.
Yeah.
Augustine, these traditional theological sources, they are not the problem. They're not the liability. The liability is somewhere else.
Right.
And where do you locate that liability?
I locate the liability in thinking that we have only had Christianity for the last 500 years. That our Old Testament is way older. The visions, the pre-Christian world is much older than 500 years old.
Yeah. And you're talking about the Reformation.
The Reformation has been, let me just say it, be plain.
Yeah, yeah.
The Reformation has kind of like ruined the value of anything that was older than that. Hmm. Anybody who hasn't had that thought process, because creeds were older than Martin Luther. And so it wasn't like he created a new creed or he was the person. And when we went into the Reformation, we kind of threw the baby out with the bathwater and just said, Martin Luther is the answer. And that has been across the board, not just in Lutheran circles, but in every circle. We no longer use the solas. We no longer think about these old ancient faith that we have. Like, what if one day we did have to plant a tree and a rock and rebuild the altar? and we wouldn't know what that meant, because the value of the tradition of our faith has been dialed down to the last 500 years.
Let me ask this in a really, like, Old Testament way that I think you'll appreciate. The book of Deuteronomy is one of my favorite books in the Pentateuch. And part of it is because it's a teaching book. Like, if, you know, Moses is, like, literally teaching, kind of reminding. But one of the most famous or one of the most common commands he gives is to remember.
Right.
Or don't forget. You know what? Different ways that he's basically trying to get them to remember their story and where they came from, you know, how they were liberated and what it means for them to have been liberated slaves that are now going to inherit this new land. what do you feel like we need to remember? Like, if you were kind of Moses right now in the moment or in that sort of mode, what have we forgotten? What do we not remember?
I mean, remember that churches were first houses of prayer. Like, remember that prayer is the thing that moves mountains, literally. I mean, there is a historical account of one of the sons of Zebedee, John, how he went into the temple of Diana and prayed a 26-word prayer, and the temple exploded and the altar imploded. And it's a historical account.
That's incredible.
And to believe that we have an ancient faith that can perform this type of prayer and believe that it's actually action and faith in God, not just in our commentators, our theologians. It's a faith that's experienced with Jesus.
Let's go to the prayer thing. I didn't expect we would go here, but I'm glad that you took us.
Yeah.
Prayer is action.
Yeah.
So in for really good reasons, after mass shootings, right? Like, people often say, you know, we offer prayers. And that's become a kind of a bit of a rallying cry, too, of like, not just prayers, right?
Right.
And that's right, right? Yeah. And I fully agree with that. Like, prayers are not enough, I guess, is another way to say it. But I think oftentimes, especially this is true of the mainline, we forget that prayer is not just like self-therapy.
Yeah.
But that it is actually action.
Right.
And I think there is a kind of default, almost like an atheism to our prayer that does not view it as something that is a true work on behalf of the neighbor, a true action, and something that we are called to do alongside all the other things. And I just wondered, it sounds to me like you have a theology of prayer that views it as actual action that is effective.
Yeah, I believe we talked about this a little bit. We have the Acts of the Apostles that a lot of people like to talk about, but we never talk about the Acts of the Prophets.
Hmm.
And how they have these moments. In every book of a major prophet, there's a moment that they're actually being silent. But they're praying for their city and the world, the Jerusalem, to change in that moment, for them to get a new message in their prayer. Like we talk about Isaiah Lane and Jeremiah, we being a weeping prophet, his prayer over crying. His prayer laying in dung. I mean,
yeah, like Ezekiel's story. Oh, yeah, that's a wild story.
Yeah, the wild stories that really change, but they were prayers. Like, they were connected with God, and God told them to do something that was out of the world. Like, even Hosea, he said, marry this prostitute. Right. And show them that they were not my people, and they will be my people. So that lets us know that as we connect with God and he gives us commands through prayer, and we be obedient to those commands, our world will change.
Hmm.
And most of the time, the reason that things don't change is because we stop being obedient. And we get scared and fearful, and we think somebody's going to think we're crazy. But the Holy Spirit has a ministry of remembrance.
That's really
And
well
he's going to remind us of what God says and how powerful that ministry is of his. I mean, even in Isaiah 62, I call them the power chapters, 62 through 62.
I totally agree.
These are like these power chapters of where he's saying, pray first. He tells us, pray so much that we don't give him rest.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned these chapters. So these chapters are very close to my heart for a couple of reasons. One, my dissertation was on chapter 60 in part. But it goes deeper than that, that I first heard my call to ministry in chapter 60.
Yeah.
So 62 verse 1, here we go. It's in the first person. For Zion's sake, I will not keep silent. And for Jerusalem's sake, I will not rest until her vindication shines out like the dawn and her salvation like a burning torch. And I thought, that is the kind of God that we have, who will not keep silent, will not rest until these things happen. That's the faithfulness of God, but that's also the faithfulness that we're called to.
Right.
Right. And so to work and to labor, alongside the work of the Spirit.
I mean, yeah. verse 6 tells yeah. us. He has that command that he will not rest.
Yes.
And he's calling us to not rest as watchmen yes. or watchpersons yeah. on the tower. He says, do not rest because yeah. I will come, but make me not rest. Like, what a crazy
what a crazy
thought process of prayer that God is asking the church to pray so much that he gets annoyed with the prayers and he will respond in righteousness. And I mean, other vindication is righteousness, which is justice. That's right,
yeah. No, this is like the notion of intercessor as the what's the word, the sentinel or the watch.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about, like the watchman on the wall or the watchperson on the wall.
Yeah, I think that's all of us.
Yeah.
And if we're praying, if we're in mainline churches and churches in the outskirts, churches on the fringe, we depend on prayer. Like when we don't have any more answers. You mind if I tell a little story?
Yeah, please. Of course.
Yeah, so my first son was premature. And this is the first time I ever experienced like real powerlessness. Romans 5 is really like we were yet without power.
Yeah.
He gave us Jesus, who had all the power, right? So my son was like in this NICU. My wife was like, she still today believes she could have died on that hospital bed. Like she had preeclampsia and the placenta just started to separate. And he just came in abrupt at 3 o'clock in the morning. We had no support. We couldn't call nobody. Nobody could come and be with us. So it was like, it wasn't like a regular pregnancy. It wasn't the joyous moment that you're looking for. And as soon as he was born, he came out. He was beautiful. Big feet, big hands. I loved it. Then the next thing that happens is he's got like this little hiccup in his breathing and they rush him out. And we have no connection with him whatsoever. Mm. And my wife is still sleeping and sedated by all this medication. She forgets when I come in and out. And I remember we were in the NICU. We couldn't even touch him. We couldn't even put our hands on him yet. And then all of a sudden, like the third day, they let us do skin to skin. And I remember they were about to tell us if he was going to go home or not. And they said, no, the doctor thinks he needs to stay longer. And our hearts dropped. And I remember us going into one of the, they have like the breastfeeding rooms. And my wife just started to weep. And I just started to weep with her. And I realized in that moment, I couldn't do anything. I couldn't do nothing. And then all of a sudden, my wife was weeping. I was weeping. And then in the midst of that weeping, in my powerlessness, I prayed. And I prayed with pain and compassion and hurt and disappointment. And I just remember how powerless I was in praying. Mm-hmm. And that moment changed how I thought about the love of God and how he wants us to connect with us in every moment of our life. And even in that powerlessness, he still moved when I was powerless.
Gosh, you know, that is so powerful. So our friend Joe Davis was recently at my church and you saw that and interacted on social media. But I think it's Psalm 36, which says, God is near to the brokenhearted.
Yeah.
And I have just been, that has been going through my mind because I think like that's a powerful story. And I think that those are often the times when God seems most near is when like brokenheartedness is just there,
right,
like, on the table for everybody to see. And gosh, what a powerful story and a testimony too. But for you, that's like a story about prayer.
Yeah, it's a story about prayer. I mean, it's a story that says whoever's listening, whatever you're going through as a pastor, whatever thing that is in your circumstance, prayer is going to be the thing that's going to either bring you through it or bring you to it. Like you're going to need prayer. You're going to ask people for prayer. And if you are not asking for prayer, you're not inviting people into your life. And prayer is the easiest way to invite somebody in. I mean, we use prayer as evangelism. Yeah. We use prayer as comfort. We use prayer in every kind of circumstance. And I just felt like, man, I could pray better than I could preach it sometimes. And so just sometimes just to close our eyes and just connect with God, and that's just the preacher in me, that's just like what happens. Like, I was preaching sermons on my prayer walks in Bible college before I even stepped into a pulpit. So I think that's where prayer actually becomes reality sometimes.
Yeah. Well, I didn't anticipate that we would kind of go so long on prayer, which is awesome. I actually think it's the right thing to do. Let's keep riding this kind of scripture train. What biblical stories, OT or NT, it doesn't matter, do you most kind of see like your own sort of life reflected in it, and your own ministry reflected?
I mean, Joseph.
Joseph. Oh
my gosh.
Yeah.
When I look at the story of Joseph, no, my brothers didn't sell me out to slavery, but I was definitely sold off to slavery as being an African descendant of slaves.
Yeah.
And I was sold off in a way that when I think of Joseph and the height of his leadership and what he did and the compassion and the resurgence of his family line coming and lining back up after such an egregious action. Like, my brother sold me in a human trafficking event, and I was pure of heart. And then somebody tried to corrupt me sexually, and I still had to run, and I had to go to jail for doing the right thing constantly. And then all of a sudden, I still believe God. I still believe God in the very vision that he gave me for my life, even though every circumstance seemed like it was horrible.
Wow, that's just an incredible take on that story. It does make me think about how there are a lot of Old Testament stories about unjust incarceration.
Yeah.
Or just of people who end up on the pointy end of kind of the regime's sword. You know, I'm thinking about like Elijah.
Yeah.
Obviously the Joseph story, but I think a lot of this, I think about David's story being hunted down by Saul, but all these stories about how people end up on the wrong end of sort of sanctioned power, and how that, I think there's potential for those stories to speak in a new way.
Isn't it quite interesting that all the leaders in the Bible had a stint of imprisonment of some kind?
It's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah. So imprisonment is not something that I believe God is like keeping us from as people. But as we talk about Joseph, there was this other story in the New Testament, and it'll be Timothy's story. As Paul talks about his grandmother and mother, he says, your faith has proven.
Yeah.
And I know who they are. And so I think that's the same thing as far as my family. And so I think the women in mostly African-American families have strong faith and prayer. And I think my grandmother was a pastor's wife. My mom worked at a mega church. And so those prayers during those times proved a faith that probably lasts, that probably they are actually shocked at the extremity of my faith sometimes.
Funny. So let's dig a little bit into your kind of ministry responsibilities right now. Can you give us sort of the 30,000-foot view of your current kind of spheres of ministry and what y'all are up to?
Yeah, so Faith City, I'm the lead pastor. So right now what I do, I'm the visionary, and I'm also the main teacher and preacher on Sundays. And the number one job that I do is make disciples and train others to make disciples.
Faith City in Minneapolis.
Faith City of St. Paul.
Faith City of St. Paul, sorry.
Yeah. And so that's the main thing that I do. So every day I'm training, equipping, and making sure that people are being shepherded into the call and the vision that they're part of. And so kind of like the meta vision, as we talk, like if you're an engineer, you know that meta is the learning part of the vision. So there's a learning part that comes in with Faith City. And so that's making disciples. And so that's like our non-negotiable. And that's the thing that I push forward every single every single week in and week out.
So do you see those disciples, are those kind of the leaders that you have on the ground that are, or how do you think, let me ask this in a slightly different way. How do you think about approaching somebody for discipleship, or what, or who's in that circle, I guess, is part of what I'm trying to ask.
Yeah, so it would be a term that I used earlier in our conversation called pre-Christians. And these are people who are seekers, people who are asking questions, people who actually don't know God in any kind of framework. They're not praying in any kind of, I mean, they're praying. Everybody prays, whether you believe it or not.
We're all calling out to for a God.
We're all in distress at some point or situation in our life. But they are pre-Christians. They're not following Jesus and obeying his commands. Let me just say that's what a disciple is, someone who follows and obeys the commands of Jesus. And so the first thing is that people who are pre-Christian. So how do you do that? How do you in any way? Like, we meet them in a marketplace. Somebody who'll be a pre-Christian will ask me about marriage counseling. And through that marriage counseling, I'll share the gospel with them. Or somebody who comes into our grocery store and is hurting and feels like, man, I'm so glad that I'm able to go to a place where I can afford groceries. And I can tell them why we're doing this and why God and Jesus made this possible. And there's people who are affected by police violence. And they need somebody to shepherd them through the pain. And I'm able to share the gospel with them and their family, and people who are in bereavement and just don't know. That's another way of how we start to enter disciples. And we decided to do this in a specific neighborhood. And so we say, hey, we're really cool at what we do, but we can't do it everywhere. and our plan is not to do a whole city. It is to do multiple neighborhoods. So we focus on the neighborhood of Dayton's Bluff in St. Paul. And so we got about 5 or 6 families who are dedicated to the vision and mission of making disciples and being part of the redemptive plan of Jesus.
In Dayton's Bluff. So that involves a church. Yes. It also involves a grocery store.
Correct.
Say a little bit about the grocery store.
Yeah, the grocery store is so God gave us like I told you, a meta vision is that he wants us to end food insecurity. And so we believe compassion for the poor are preaching of poverty is like the last thing that most churches do in the main line. And so we believe that we are a church for the poor, and we are people who live among the poor in our community. Our community is one of the top 5 impoverished neighborhoods in the state of Minnesota. So all of Minnesota, Dayton's Bluff is number 5. And so we believe that us being there, and so we do feeding. We believe that ended food insecurity can happen in this generation. And so that's where the grocery store comes in. We believe in empowering people. People get food stamps. People work. They have money. And just giving away groceries is not empowering them in my mindset. Mm. Empowering them is that they get to buy and afford groceries that they can assess each and every day. That, to me, is empowerment.
So you were pretty deliberate about this is not going to be like a food bank model or food shelf model kind of idea. It was about making food accessible.
Correct.
Like physically, you know, there and accessible, but also affordable.
Correct. Yeah. Very, very laser focused in that.
Yeah. And so that takes a whole different skill set around, you know, knowing how to, you know, sort of the supply chain side, how to run a business, how to set this kind of thing up in terms of the physical space. And was that experience you already had, or did you have to sort of learn how to do
grocery store?
That?
I worked at grocery stores as kids. I was a bagger. Yeah, I worked in almost every department. I worked in the meat department, the deli department. I knew the ins and outs. I knew how simple it was at a point. But purchasing was anybody will sell you groceries, to tell you the truth, if you want to start a grocery store. Hmm. And so
that's not a problem.
That's not a problem. Yeah. Finding suppliers. The problem is making it affordable. And so that's one of the things, like we had to find a partner that could make it affordable. And Hy-Vee was our partner.
Oh, okay. So that was, I wasn't sure if you'd be able to kind of, you know, speak to those details. But so let's just imagine somebody else in Minnesota lives in the number 3 neighborhood. Yeah. Right? You have number 5, somebody's in number 3, or whatever it happens to be. They say, hey, I want to do something like that. What are some of the things they need to, kind of the challenges they would need to think through?
Yeah, the challenges would be, like, when you would start, because in business, we don't know when things are going to work until we start doing it. Yeah. So it may actually not work in your neighborhood. It may be something that that people aren't very welcoming to, because one, they've never had a grocery store in their neighborhood. They don't know what that means. They're used to the, like, you know, the trends. They're used to the trends of driving out of their neighborhood to get groceries. And so that is something, like, if there's other neighborhood groceries in there that are pretty successful and been there for a long time, then that may work for your neighborhood.
Yeah.
It may, they may not have the accessible things. Like, if there's a liquor store, a corner store, those are C stores. And then I would think about, like, what products that people need and how they could keep that low, at low cost and accessible. Yeah. Like, if somebody comes in and spend $20, they want to walk out feeling valued.
Right.
Yeah, and that they don't want to say, man, I can only buy, like, two things.
Right, with 20 bucks.
Like we do at Target all the time.
Yeah. But it's, I mean, is it, so inflation is obviously an issue right now. Yeah. And do is you it? Guys feel that? Is it? Do you guys feel that on the grocery side? Or do you, have you figured out a way to make it less impactful for the people you serve?
I think groceries are just expensive because they make a lot of money. Mm. It is a $50 billion industry.
So you think it's the profit side that makes it expensive, not the supply.
So the first thing you got to cut out is transportation cost. Huh. Like, a grocery store is already going to get deliveries each and every week. So if you partner with a big box, they're not paying extra for delivery.
Because they're already getting a lot of stuff.
They're already getting a lot of stuff. So you buying from them is actually making them money. So it's not like you're stopping them from getting the increase. So partnering with a big box is always helpful.
So you're buying straight from a big box like Hy-Vee.
Yeah.
And you're not having to sort of help them reclaim money that they lost through transportation.
Right.
So you can get it at a price that actually works for the people you're serving.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it works for them because we use Hy-Vee has like a product line that is very a value product line.
Sure.
And so we sell the value product line and other items that people ask for. And then the second thing I would tell somebody is build a team of people who could support you in either volunteering or either helping you out with your budget or bringing like an advisory group together when you start a grocery store, because you can't do it alone. Even though somebody, one person will be running it, which we have seen for years, one family running a grocery store, that is like all they can do.
Yeah.
And so like most people will always come up and ask me, hey, pastor, how are you going to pastor and do this the same? And I would say, this is part of my pastoring. Like, day in and day out, like, we're not a traditional mainline church. We are people who gather and communicate in and outside of the church. So, like, having a grocery store actually makes sense to us.
Yeah. In your vision of how God has called you to pastor.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, we've got the church, the grocery store, and I think there's at least one other thing in the mix, right?
So what we've done, there's a couple of other things in the mix. And my wife said this to me a couple of months ago. She said, Carl, I don't know what it is, but every time you say you're going to do something, it happens. And I say, I don't know what it is either. So crazy. And so we started the GW Carver Cultural Center for Innovation.
What's the name?
George Washington Carver Cultural Center for Innovation. One, because George Washington Carver was actually an artist. And he was a farmer, what do they call it, a botanist. And the second thing is that we wanted to bring innovation around food. Like, the food and culture, food is so much culture. Like, if you want to be cross-cultural, the first thing you do is go to a restaurant.
Go to a restaurant, right?
Yeah. So we know that food is cross-cultural. And the thing that we did with the GW Carver houses, like, three different things: Storehouse Grocers, Faith City Church, and our workforce development program. And so this year we are starting to do workforce development within our community, give people skills and jobs within a neighborhood so that they can start to flourish. And that is what we're doing right now. And so that is the last thing right now is our workforce development. And we plan on being able to help people start. We have a social kitchen that will launch probably next summer. Not this summer, but next summer. And social kitchen will train young cooks, give them 6 months like certificates, and they'll be able to go to restaurants and get jobs, and we have partner restaurants already signing MOUs for that because they need staff and labor. And so we believe that in this redemptive plan, there's so much that we can do. But we said to ourselves, if anybody should be doing cultural centers, it should be churches. And we are one of the churches that really believe in culture.
Yeah,
we're not having cultural wars. We love people. We love the global church. We love people of all peoples. And so if we continue to love all people, then we'll start to see, the church grow.
Where are you all at in the Carver Center project?
We are at the end of this month, we'll be relaunching a grocery store. We have remodeled a building. The church is currently meeting in the building. So in the process, we have a coffee shop and grocery store opening up at the end of this month.
Nice. And where could people kind of keep track of you, the ministry, progress, all that stuff?
Yeah, so they could jump on LinkedIn and find me, Pastor Carl Johnson, Faith City Church. And then you can find me on social media. I'm on TikTok. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. My Old Testament, you would like this. My tag is 1-4 City out of Jeremiah. Yeah. TikTok, Righteous Rev. And then on Twitter, Carl on Faith. And so that's my many handles, not one handle altogether.
Yeah. Well, that's all of it's going to be linked, linked below.
Yeah.
Carl, you've been so generous with your time, and I am just so grateful to have had this last year to get to know you. To learn from you and to observe somebody who I really think embodies what it means to be apostolic and does it with generosity, with humility, and with a deep passion for the gospel. So, Carl, thanks for your time.
No, thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Gospel Beautiful podcast. I really hope that you benefited from the conversation. If you did, make sure to leave a 5-star review. Also, make sure that you're subscribed so that you can receive updates whenever new episodes drop. Thank you very much.